You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 64 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. It feels good to say that again.
It feels good to be back.
to not be recording this over the computer and me having to spend like an hour editing it so I can take out the echo when the other person is talking.
Over the computer, sometimes at 2:30 a.m.
Yeah. I did not post last week's episode until approximately 4 a.m.
Well, I mean, the previous one you had to post the next day.
Yes, that is correct.
So it feels good to be back on normal time. We're back into it.
I was on Mountain Time at one point, and then I was on Vegas Time, which is just a time zone all its own.
Well, we're also back to one of our favorite traditions.
What tradition is that?
And that is the Sierra Nevada Beer Camp Summer Pack.
First off, I wish you would have gone, you've been traveling the country, and now we're going to be world travelers when it comes to beer. That would have been my transition.
Okay.
Just wanted to get that in there.
Next time. So the last three summers, Sierra Nevada has collaborated with some of the best breweries in the country, and now around the world to put together unique beers that are one-time beers just in this pack. And that meant the first year, this was a couple years ago, two summers ago, was the only place that we could get, at the time, I think, Founders, Three Floyds, New Glarus Brewing, some of the pillars of Midwest brewing. This was the only place that we could get something that was made in collaboration with those breweries in Seattle.
And also some of the East Coast breweries, I would say, as well.
And then last year, they came back and did it again. I think maybe they only made 6 beers last year. Am I recalling that correctly? And
that sounds vaguely correct.
But this year, they're going international.
They are.
So for the Beer Camp across the world, they're brewing with your friends, or brewing with your friends is what Beer Camp is all about. We called on 12 breweries, 6 stateside and 6 overseas, to come together for a no-limits, one-time-only collaboration pack.
It feels like the phrase no holds barred should be in there somewhere.
I almost added it myself.
Nice.
I like the idea of no limits beer making because you're still there actually a lot of limits.
You're still
making beer.
It's kind of like unlimited hydroplane racing. There's actually a ton of limits, but that's a future pod.
You'll have to save that for next week. But so we're going to be drinking through these for the next 6 weeks, 2 at a time. And I picked out 2 kind of randomly here. First off, we have the Atlantic Style Vintage Ale. Would you like to hear about that one?
Of course.
So this one was brewed with one of the overseas breweries. I think both of these were actually. So this was brewed alongside Fuller's Brewery in Chiswick, London. Chiswick may be the street it's on.
It's probably like a neighborhood.
A neighborhood? Chiswick, London. Okay. So this is with Fuller's Brewery and the Atlantic Style Vintage Ale. This is the other side of the Atlantic.
And that's what I was going to say.
So we're calling our Beer Camp collaboration an Atlantic Vintage Ale, which combines elements from Fuller's robust vintage ales with some American-style hopping techniques. We used plums in the brew to complement Fuller's naturally fruity yeast strain, and we're bottle conditioning the beer for added longevity. This beer should age well in the bottle for years to come, or if you're drinking it in the first summer. Drink it now or stash some away to revisit in the future.
First off, shout out to Kelsey Plum here.
Okay, it had to be said.
All right, what is the other beer we have here?
The other beer, do you want me to read this to you or do you want to read this one?
I'll just read the back of the bottle here.
I think it's the same thing. So the other one we have is from another overseas brewery from Wellington, New Zealand, a brewery called Garage Project.
Yeah, and this is the Camp Out Porter, brewed with vanilla and honey. In honor of Beer Camp, our friends at New Zealand's Garage Project Brewery wanted to carry the camping theme, straight through to the flavor of our beer, featuring a unique malt smoked over Manuka wood, rare Manuka honey, and vanilla beans.
It's heavy on Manuka.
This robust porter has sweet notes reminiscent of marshmallows toasted over a campfire.
Oh.
That's interesting because I don't think of porters as a summer beer, but they have tried here their best.
I like it.
To make me think of
I'm excited.
Porters as a summer beer. So I think we are each going to try one of these and then swap midway through. I believe that's the plan here. I am going to start out with the porter, and you will start out with the Atlantic style vintage ale. And then we will compare and contrast. So
Cheers. Cheers to Beer Camp. Cheers to you, Mr. International. The cool thing about the Beer
Camp... You should have gone there with to Mr. Worldwide.
The cool thing about the Beer Camp pack is that it's usually 12 different styles of beer. Then they're cans and bottles. It's kind of interesting. You know, there are really no limits when it comes to it.
No holds barred. This is tasty. I taste the honey. It's lighter than the usual porter. I think because of that.
So I can taste nice. Kelsey Plum in here.
Oh, good. It tastes of disappointed rookie seasons.
No.
Oh, no. Taste of the bench. Should we get now to our special guest? Or we're going to talk burgers first.
Let's talk burgers first.
All right. So for this week's burger review, for the first time in a while, we met up and ate together at Skillet Counter in the Armory building.
Yes.
On the Seattle Center campus, which is an underrated spot to eat, I would say.
The Armory?
Yeah.
Oh, Armory's great. Very in on the Armory.
Or maybe it's rated well. I don't know. I have no idea how people rate it, but you got Mod Pizza there.
The number one way to be a thing that is rated well, this is an argument for why I think it is rated well, is because it was so bad before. So if you start out being really bad and then you get pretty good, you'll be rated really good.
That is absolutely true. That is the contrast principle, I think.
Well, there you go. I just invented it.
You did. Weird that there's a whole bunch of science existed that I read about it recently in a book that was republished most recently, the edition that I have, in 1993.
Wow, I wrote that at the age of 8.
Yeah. You were so prolific.
What did you think of the Skillet burger?
Okay, so my main takeaway is it was a solid burger, but even though fries are included, it was like $16.30 with tax.
Yes.
And there's no way you should pay $16.30 for this burger. What did you think?
I would say that my experience going in, I get there, I order, right? I'm looking at the burger. It's a $14 burger. I ask for a tall boy because that's the cheapest thing to have. The draft beer is $6. I'm like, I'll have a tall boy. It doesn't even say Rainier tall boy. I think that was implied, but they're out of them. So then I have to get a draft beer. In total, my order was $23. That's insane for one burger and one beer, right?
That is true.
But then I took a bite of the burger. Pretty good.
Interesting. So you were higher on this burger, I think, than I was.
I was pretty high on the burger. I mean, look, I don't think it's worth the price. If this burger was $8 instead of $14, which is almost half as much, if this burger was $8, I would say that it would be close to a lock to me for being in the top 8 burgers.
Interesting. It was really relatively rare, I think, for Patty.
It was probably the rarest burger we've had.
That's what I would say. Yeah.
The meat tastes good. They have a special sauce, which kind of permeated everything. I kind of liked it.
There was a lot of special sauce, and I'm good with that.
You didn't eat the pickles, but they were good pickles. They were solid. They're not the round pickles. It's a long shaved pickle.
I would say the only particular complaint I had with this burger is that the cheese kind of got overwhelmed by the special sauce in the patty.
If they would have had a second piece of cheese, it would have been nice.
So
I could have used a little bit more cheese flavor.
The fries were generally pretty good.
What is that they put in their fries? The green stuff?
I don't know. Cilantro?
Like rosemary or something? They're very overwhelming with whatever spice it is that they put in their fries. I'd say they're a little bit crispy for my taste also. I like a soft, greasy fry. I don't like a hard, crispy fry.
You know I like a crispy fry. But I would say my other takeaway here is there's a reason I've gone to Skillet many times in my life, probably at least a half dozen, and never once had the burger.
Yes.
And it's not, and maybe this is a reason we shouldn't even have included it. I don't think it's their thing. Like,
really?
My takeaway was if I go there, I'm going to order their breakfast sandwich, the Chub.
So when the Skillet truck first came around, I felt like their thing was the burger with bacon jam.
I would agree with that. Yes. That's part of why I agreed to put them on the list is because I think originally it was their thing.
And then neither of us got that burger.
No.
I just looked at it and I said to myself, I would rather have this burger. And it was pretty good. I know myself.
You are familiar with your own taste.
And I've had the bacon jam burger, and I don't really like it.
Interesting. I have not had it, as I noted.
So I've
not had it at any of their burgers.
I've had it at the truck, and I've just thought it was fine. Actually, I thought it was bad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
actively bad.
Go to Skillet.
Why
did we include Skillet?
I don't know. It was first off, it was very convenient, because I literally walked over from Key Arena during halftime
of
the Storm game.
It was very convenient. But you'll hear this with our special guest that we have coming up next. For the price, I could have gotten 2 Red Robin burgers plus bottomless fries twice and of like 24-ounce beer for the same price, maybe even less.
I suppose so.
You don't think that's true? I mean, numerous burgers at Red Robin that are $5.
Yeah, there's the one like special burger that they have. Their default burger is like $5.
I think they even have some special burgers for $5. Huh. Now we're arguing about Red Robin.
Yeah, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. There's going to be a lot more Red Robin
talk. You're going to hear a lot more Red Robin talk later, and you're going to love
it. We're spoiling it.
But this, to me, it was just too high of a price point to really consider it.
So what did you rate this?
I rated an 87.
I rated an 85. This is one of those many times where like we have such contrasting takes, and then our ratings end up almost the same.
I think food-wise, it's a little bit higher, but the price point brings it down. And the fries, I didn't think were great.
I enjoyed the fries more than you did, partially because I like crispy fries. So next week is going to be the conclusion of the regular season of the search for Seattle's Best Burger, which is shorter than the MLS regular season.
I mean, by far.
Yeah. We started not that much longer, earlier than the start of the MLS regular season. And there's still like 6 months left to go in that sucker. So then we will be selecting, as we've alluded to in the past, we will be selecting our top 8 burgers on the basis of their rankings and possibly just however we feel like, whatever we feel like should be in the top 8.
Gut feeling, QBR, quarterback wins, yards per attempt.
Definitely yards per attempt. It correlates well to winning. So we will be choosing our
top 8. The eye test.
We will be choosing our top 8. Then over the 4 weeks of August, we will be conducting 4 quarterfinals with head-to-head tests of these burgers is rated by us and the third Pelton brother that week.
I am so excited for this.
I'm so excited for us to pick third Pelton brothers who do not know who they are yet. Have not yet been selected. And then at a special event in the future, we will be going through our 4 finalists and choosing a winner.
Oh, I thought we were doing just the finals. We're doing the whole final 4?
Well, I mean, the way the math works out, I think it pretty much has to be that.
Oh, okay.
So otherwise, we'll see.
Not like you know anything about math.
Yeah, what do I know about that? So stay tuned for that. We hope to review several burgers. We're obviously not going to get to all of the ones that are on the map and on our list. We just ran out of time at some point, sadly, because of the fact that our schedule, we wanted to get this wrapped up before the start of the football season when our focus will sort of shift more heavily towards sports.
But there are still some burgers that I want to try.
Yeah, and this doesn't have to be the end of our search. It doesn't have to be the ultimate finish line. Yes. There will be new burgers that come up. We'll get a chance to review some of these places. But the in terms of actually crowning a champion, this will be the end of the burgers considered.
Man, I'm so excited. So you think JJ Redick should be the first third Pelton brother?
I don't know. I heard that now he's on the Uninterrupted Network, so I don't know if he's allowed to appear on our podcast anymore. We may be a rival.
Okay. Okay, so we'll call him off. We'll start with Channing Frye. Wait, is that the same network?
It is, yes.
Oh, everybody's out.
You know who's not on a podcast?
Who's that?
And maybe in Seattle at that point, Nick Collison.
Oh, really?
That actually would be a great idea.
He'd be a perfect third Pelton brother.
Such a good third Pelton brother. All right. On that note, I think it's time to bring on our special guest.
So we continue Pelton Cast Music Month here, talking about a festival that's coming up this weekend in Capitol Hill Block Party. And I'm going to introduce here Eli Anderson, the talent buyer for Numos, Barboza, and Capitol Hill Block Party. And a festival that I've worked really closely with. I booked a stage at Block Party, the Vera stage, for 8 years.
I forgot about that. I do. I remember it now. And I was like, oh,
you're asking
totally.
If I knew Jason. I was like, yeah, I know.
Obviously, yeah.
But that I booked the Vera stage at for 8 years, had the privilege over that time to book artists like The Head and the Heart, Macklemore, Starfucker, people like that. And Fleet Foxes, their first ever performance at Block Party. So being able to book those artists, and then over time, you came on to take over, and you came on and took over the festival booking.
Took
main
your
stage.
Job. I'm sorry.
Kind of. Took my job plus so much more. I mean, I was just doing the Vera stage, but you took on everything else.
Yeah, that's true.
So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I think we want to talk. It's a festival that, like I mentioned, is very close to me, and we think of it in terms of Seattle is kind of divided. You've got kind of the 3 festivals over the summer. The summer starts with Sasquatch. Halfway through, you've got Block Party, and then ends with Bumbershoot. And I'm curious to hear from you kind of what you think Block Party means to Seattle.
Man, that's a great question. To me, Block Party it's big enough to attract things that are of a national interest and to do, you know, the 8,000 to 10,000 people we do a day. But it's also still small enough that we could do things that are developing and still have those things be things that generate excitement within the audience. I feel like with Sasquatch and Bumbershoot, they're so big and they're controlled by such large companies that sometimes it's all top line and the things in the middle is where it gets mushy and weird. But at Block Party, you can do things that are still small, still emerging, still just stuff that would just sell at Numo's and do the 650 tickets. But in the context of Block Party outside on Capitol Hill during hopefully the nicest weekend of the summer, you know, it's still something that it really excites sort of the fan base that we have, which is weird.
What do you think it means for local bands? Because, I mean, it definitely, those other festivals have local bands, but Block Party, you look at the lineup and it's almost, I don't know if you know the percentage.
I think it's like it's 60 to 70% because it's really only the main stage and the Vera stage that have national acts. After you left or whatever and I started, we sort of phased that out in terms of like having national acts playing Numos or Barbosa just because it was too limiting. Like we're paying all this money and flying all these people out and they can play for 500 people in this room. Like that's not, you know, that's not what they want either. So it's a big deal because you're billed alongside all that stuff. And when you look at the single day bills, like the local bands start at like the 10th thing there. So it's like, you know, Run the Jewels is here and you're right there, you know?
So when do you kind of start thinking about what the Block Party lineup is going to look like? How long is that process of building it?
It's probably 14 to 18 months at this point. Like we started getting submissions, like for real submissions, probably at the start of last month. We're not going to like move on anything that soon, but you start thinking about like, okay, these are the things I want. I want this many of this kind of band and this many of that kind of band. So there's a little bit of like straight math in terms of like, you need this many hip hop things, you need this many indie rock things. But then it just comes down to like, are the people who go to Block Party going to like this or that, or do they want more of this or less of that? And, you know, being here for, this will be year 6 or 7, I think, you know, you get a pretty good sense of like what the crowd that comes is going to react
to. Of Block Party artists.
Yeah, exactly. With the Block Party artists. Exactly.
How much do you consider? So this year you've got headliners. Your headliners are Lord Huron, kind of an indie rock band, Diplo, an electronic group, and then Run the Jewels, a hip hop group. Is that intentional where you try to have kind of those three genres represented?
Yeah, basically. Like on our schedule or whatever, we have a color coding system for genres and stuff. But that, even that is like a little, it's malleable. Like, you know, you can't just say like, oh, if we have 2 hip hop acts and 3 indie rock things and 4 EDM things, then we're successful for that day. But, you know, you get the sense that the people who come, they want a little bit more of the electronic stuff. They want the EDM dance stuff and they love hip hop. And a certain kind of indie rock still gets through and still makes an impact or whatever. So it's just, you want that mix. You want it to be diverse. We're not hard festival. We're not, you know, we're not a hip hop festival, but we're also not Bumbershoot. We can't have top 40 artists play, really. We don't have the money for that.
How much do you feel the pressure? You look at a festival like Bumbershoot, and they have, I think, 2 electronic headliners this year, and then also Lord, who's not that far off. How much do you feel the pressure for booking more electronic music?
I mean, it's big right now, and it has been pretty much since I started. Like, that's what sells the most tickets. That's what really motivates people. You know, in the context of a festival, too, you see something like Paradiso, which is the other festival that happens around here, that's a total EDM, dance music, DJs. It's the only festival that's going to sell out this year, probably.
Yes.
So it's still something that motivates people. But we also can't have the same stuff that Paradiso does.
Yes.
It's not going to translate to the super cool kid that comes to Block Party. It's, you know, it's weird how the sort of the line is drawn. Because you get those submissions and you're like, well, this artist is huge. Like, absolutely. Like, I see it, but it's not going to play at Block Party the same way.
What is it like competing with, I mean, you're also competing with Paradiso, I guess, for electronic artists, but competing with those festivals and booking these artists?
It's, I mean, Bumbershoot for years was kind of this thing that we were just like happy to coexist with because we did not cross over at all.
Yeah.
And then AEG took over and their bookings got way more in our world. I mean, I feel like they skew a little younger than us even.
Yes.
And they have more money to spend and they're interested. I mean, we would love to have Lord. Does Lord want to play Block Party?
Yes.
But, you know, we don't want the money to pay Lord to come play Block Party. So, you know, there's competition. But
she listens to this podcast. Big fan.
I knew it. She was always retweeting you and those just had like millions of retweets and the other ones not so much. But yeah, I mean, we would love to do that kind of stuff. So there's this weird line between like, yeah, I mean, I would love that stuff to play, but it doesn't really fit in with us budget wise or, and it doesn't really fit with us programming wise either. Like we have to be smaller. We have to be cooler. We have to be a little bit underground. Not that Diplo is like an underground. He wrote like a Justin Bieber record. He's not an unknown quantity, but you know what I mean?
How much, I would always hear this a lot when booking the Vera stage, and it feels like general public thinks that every single band represents your own personal taste. And it's like, look, this represents availability,
yeah,
budget.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff.
Like, what will sell tickets.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, why didn't you book Kanye West for the festival?
Well, we were deep in talks with him, but we couldn't get his floating stage to come out.
Yeah.
It is really funny, like, because I post my stuff for Block Party on my Facebook page. Be like, hey, I worked a year on this. Like, yeah. I'm excited that we're announcing we're going to sell tickets. But, like, all my friends are 35-year-old dads, and it's sort of like, oh, Wolf Parade's playing. Like, that's the thing that people are so excited about.
You're like, Kevin is sounds good.
Furiously nodding. But, like, you know, so you have to, it keeps me more involved, yeah, for sure, because I was wondering that the other day. I was just going through my Spotify trying to, like, what do I want to hear? And I was like, would I even know what half of this is if it wasn't my job to know, yeah, what half of this is? I mean, I genuinely like a lot of it, but it's just like, how fast would you just sort of, like, divorce yourself from, yes, music? And from,
I think about that a lot.
If I didn't have to do it.
Are there any artists, when you look at this year's lineup, are there any artists where you look at and you're like, that's a person who I booked because I like them?
No Name is a big one there. Awesome. Evan, who I work with at Numo's, he books Barboza mostly, but he books Numo's stuff, and he started booking the Numo's and Vera stages this year. But he sent that to me.
He's the new me now.
He's the new you. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
He sent that to me, and we were both listening to it, and it was kind of like, this is really good, right? Yeah. And it was just her SoundCloud page. And then she got picked up by an agency and stuff, the one you work for. But she got picked up by them, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, we got to do this. Yes. Like, this, it wasn't just my weird taste. It's like somebody else really liked it. But that's sort of an example of, like, a big thing. A lot of the smaller stuff, sometimes you go for, like, Wand played the festival a couple of years ago. That was 100% because I wanted to see Wand.
Nice.
Same because when Proto Martyr played, that was, I wanted to see them, and I was like, cool, I think hopefully people will like you. I really want to see you. So
what's the actual weekend like for you? Are you able to enjoy the shows?
About halfway through, probably. Usually Friday is a little hectic because it's a lot of, like, troubleshooting and, like, this went wrong or that went wrong, you know, you're kind of getting settled in. So Friday is a little weird usually. But usually halfway through Saturday, it kind of, like, oh, like, this is just happening now. And it just, yes, starts rolling. Everybody gets in there, you know, remembers how it works. And so, yeah, about half the festival.
All right, then, do you have a favorite, like, Block Party day or night or a
There's a slot that I always look forward to, and now I specifically try to book things.
Nice.
So I think it was in 2013, War on Drugs played on the Sunday right before the sun went down, so they play from, like, 7:30 to all, like, 8:45 or whatever.
The perfect slot for
which
War
is pretty much exactly. Yeah. But then we had Father John Misty play the next year, and it was kind of like, that was really awesome too. Yeah. And when he played too, it had poured down rain the day before, which was such a disaster and this huge stressful thing. And everybody left and we're like, oh no, are we going to be able to keep going? But then everybody came back. And so we just were able to do it again. And by the time he went on, like, you know, the thousands of people, wherever they went when it was pouring down rain, all
they
just
came out of their
they
holes.
Just came back and he played and the sun came out and there was a rainbow and it was like, oh my God, this is, like, super awesome.
I mean, I guess that's another thing that distinguishes Block Party from some of the other festivals is obviously you get a little of this with Bumbershoot and Queen Anne, but you're very much in the middle of a neighborhood.
Yeah,
people,
totally.
If it rains, they can go to a bunch of bars here and then come back when
right,
it gets nice.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of integrate Block Party into the neighborhood?
Well, it's a lot of working with the people who are, especially if in the area that we block off and, like, you know, you can't come to the furniture store that's down the street,
yes,
or to Sam's Tavern or whatever. Although the bars especially obviously do well because people want to have a drink and
they like
out.
The weekend.
Yeah, they like the weekend, I feel like. But we've been really lucky. Like, the city's super cooperative with us and the businesses in the area generally really like it. I mean, there's certain places that it's harder for them than others, but we try to figure that out. But it is interesting to be like, hey, come to Block Party, and if you don't like the band, you could just walk down the street and go have dinner and,
yes,
come back, and it's totally, you're not going to miss that much. So yeah, it's pretty cool that way.
Yeah, I remember when it expanded to the third day and it was like a 1 year thing. And now it's forever.
Yeah, totally. I feel like once I got the taste, that was before I started. But they had the opportunity to book Dead Weather, which,
yeah,
was a big deal, Jack White and all that. So they jumped at it and jumped through all the hoops. But once, you know, once you have that third day, it's like, oh, we could do this for 3 days now.
Yeah,
like,
there's no going back.
Why not? Yeah, totally.
So you mentioned the Dead Weather. Last year, I feel like you guys had one of the most deceptively huge headliners. So the headliner, I guess the overall festival headliner, was a group called Odessa.
Yeah.
Which our listener is probably not aware is maybe the biggest group in the country.
Yeah, they are a massive, massive
group. See, the skeptical face that you're giving. We're talking a group who is playing the Forum, sold out 3 nights at Greek Berkeley, playing Barclays Center.
They did like four nights at Red Rocks. And like, I really get the sense that they could have done like eight or nine.
They could have played Red Rocks there every single day of the year.
Which is crazy. That's a huge venue.
And really, you're looking up who it is.
I know who they are. I'm just looking up how big they are.
How big of a deal it is.
I think we actually talked about this at some point last summer, and then I've forgotten it since then.
Okay, we're fighting over a microphone here to argue about how popular Odessa is.
They're very popular.
It's like the only conversation that I have because it's so weird. They're not a pop artist.
Yeah, they're not like necessarily like on the radio all the time or like in your face constantly, but they're worth real tickets and their fans are super devoted.
Yes.
And yeah, they played Block Party last year, which is crazy.
So I think of it kind of like you had Paul McCartney playing on the streets of Capitol Hill.
The Paul McCartney for the 16 to 24-year-old set. Sure, yes. Yeah.
What was it like having them? Did you have to make any special concessions? Did you have to do anything differently?
No, actually. We actually tried to make a lot of concessions to them because it was sort of pitched to us, which was very like, oh, for real? You want to play Block Party? Because we'd had them tour a couple times before that. One time when they were very small, they played like first on the Sunday on the main stage, and they had done Barboza or something before. They weren't that big of a deal at that point, but it was like, oh, we like this group, and they're nice guys, and they're just up in Bellingham. It was really easy. And then a couple years later, we're like, oh, we'll have them back. And yeah, they could totally play later in the day. And, you know, we had them back. And then that was coming around, and their agent hit us up and was like, the guys are really interested in playing Block Party. Do you want to put together an offer? And he was very like, we know kind of what your budget is, so you're going to have to expand that a little bit to make it happen. And so we worked with them a lot just to sort of make it a comfortable, you know, didn't pay him like $10,000. I'm like, thanks a lot, guys. Like, I mean, everybody. Everybody made out well on that, but it was they wanted to do this big thing where they had like a marching band, they want to have a string section, the stage at Block Party is not very big just by virtue of the fact that the street is only so wide and you need to have a fire lane and all that. So it was a lot of work like sort of in prep once they were booked. But like we made the offer and we're very like, oh, well, Bumbershoot's gonna get it. Yeah. It's fine. Like we just know it'll happen. And then they called us one day and I was like, okay, the guys really want to do this.
That's awesome.
It was like, but they had to play the Saturday. That was like the only thing that we wanted them to play the Sunday, they played the Saturday. That was like the big
concession. Typically like having, because Diplo's playing the Sunday this year.
Yeah, because the Sunday is generally a slightly harder sell than the Friday or
Saturday.
It's
the slower day. So you get
the biggest thing on the Sunday to get the people in.
And they want to have the party.
Yeah, totally. And it was, I mean, they were great and it was so packed and like, but it wasn't like bad packed where it was like, ugh, nobody can move. It's like everybody wanted to be there so badly that it was awesome. It was great.
We went that day with my then 4-year-old child.
I'm sure he loved it.
We watched Carsey Headdress and it was like, we need to leave.
It's after getting, Carsey like, way too weird.
Done and we had to get out of there.
That's his favorite band, though, yeah?
It is his favorite band.
That's amazing.
His other favorite band, and he'll thank you for this, is a band called Whitney, who are playing this year.
Oh, yeah. I love them.
And they've only played at bars so far in Seattle, so he has a chance to see them.
Matt, he loves the hard rock or the hard rock, the more rock, and he loves the soft rock.
If you would have booked Kevin Morby, I feel like he might have got a hug.
Oh, man, that would have been so good. He's got a taste already. How old is your kid?
He's 5 now.
How do you get him to have taste?
You just
because my kid, I love my child so much, and she's like really, she likes music, obviously, but she likes no adult music. She likes kid stuff.
She likes no adult. How old is she?
Three.
Three.
But she's very adult.
You'll get there. Do you want to jump in here? Okay. Parenting advice.
I'm just like she likes Yellow Submarine by the Beatles.
Yeah, it was his first favorite song.
Yeah, and I gave her a 7-inch I got for Record Store Day. This is Flaming Lips doing Space Oddity.
Does she know how to play it?
She does.
Nice.
She can't really do the whole thing herself, but she wants to like stand there while you flip it over and put it on. And she likes that Flaming Lips. They're doing Space Oddity by Bowie, and then the other side's an original, and she likes the original better, which is cool. So I was like, oh, cool. She's like getting in the music, but then I'll like put something on that like we have friends that have kids and like, oh, they really love this or that, and it's no interest. Just like zoom, she doesn't care.
It'll happen eventually.
Yeah, guys,
maybe when she turns 4, that's when it'll happen.
Yeah, that's the big 4-year-old. She's too cool for the kid music.
That's when the kids get
no more Sheriff Callie's Wild West. It's gonna be whatever school them.
Wait, so back to Block Party.
Yeah, sorry.
So we were talking about local bands, and when I was booking the Vera stage, we have all these artists like the Head and the Heart playing first on the stage. All these artists who end up becoming much bigger. And I'm curious if there's anybody this year, if you would recommend to the listener, if there's one artist who, especially a local artist, who you think has the chance of being a big name from Seattle.
I mean, we just did this thing. I was on television on New Day Northwest.
Nice.
And Little Bub was on, which was super exciting.
Little Bub.
But they wanted an artist to come on, and it was very like last minute, and it was like, who has like an easy setup? And so we had St. Clair come and do it. And this kid has done like string arrangements for Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. And like he lives in Twisp, or he came from Twisp. And like I was familiar with like, you know, his 8 songs on his SoundCloud. And I was like, he's good. I think he'll come down. And I showed up a little bit early because they were sound checking. And I was like, holy moly, this kid is like, so, like live. It was like he can sing, he plays the violin, and him and his producer guy, they write and arrange the whole thing. And so, I don't know, just seeing that and watching them play that song 5 times for soundcheck, I was like, this is a really good song.
It's better every time.
Yeah, totally. Like, I like the song as much the last time as I did the first. So I'm excited to see his whole set.
What stage are they on?
They're playing the Vera stage on Saturday. Cosmos are really good. They're playing the main stage. It's kind of like a live band, hip-hop sort of thing. They're really terrific.
I think that's a cool slot when local bands get kind of the early main stage.
Yeah, the
slots.
Early main stage. We had the Dip play there a couple years ago, who I really like. They're really sweet boys, and they did really great at that slot.
That's odd. It's like a rite of passage slot.
Yeah, totally. I feel like that, you know, because we don't have a lot of local music on the main stage. So like the 2 or 3 things that'll happen, it's like, you know, they better be good, and they're going to be good.
Is there anybody at the national level? I was looking at, we were here a couple of years ago, and Angel Olsen is playing, I think, first on the Sunday.
Right.
And then now she's drawn outside.
Yeah, totally.
She's literally on the building of Pneumo. Is there anybody who you can think of who's playing maybe nationally who you could see their profile increasing?
Well, she's playing that Magic slot this year.
Oh, which really?
Which is like something I thought long and hard about. It's like she has to be in that slot.
Nice.
I really like Miramasa, who this will be his first show in America.
Really?
It's just him and a bass player, and his record just came out this last weekend. He's really terrific. He produced a couple songs on that ASAP Rocky record that came out a couple years ago. Who else is playing that's really great? I mean, Perfume Genius is amazing. I'm excited to see him. Miki Blanco, the same thing.
And this is the first Perfume Genius show in Seattle since his record came out.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that. That record's so good. It's so good.
I think the timing worked out really well.
Yeah. So, and he's great. And I remember seeing him at the Crocodile back when I booked there. And he was just like sad guy sitting at the piano. And like...
yes.
I'll just tell the story real fast. You can cut it out if you
no,
really care.
No, I want to hear this.
So he played, and Matador was going to sign him, and all the Matador people flew from New York for it, and Trey Manny was going to book him, and he came down, and he signed him up that night or whatever. But, like, there's essentially only those people in the room. No one really knew who he was. And he played his set super sad, super beautiful, and he had his partner or his boyfriend or whatever sitting next to him at the piano because he was so nervous that he couldn't play. And so we watched him play his set. It was really great. And then afterwards, I was still working the production too, so I had to pay him. And I was like, where is he? I couldn't find him. I had his check, and I was like, ask Trey. I was like, where's Mike? You know, I just got to give him his money. He's like, I don't know where he went. I was like, well, I'll just hang out in the showroom because he got to pick up his stuff eventually. So I just sat on the little bench in there. I'm like, God, what am I going to say to this guy when he comes out? Like, he was like Cat Power style. Is this dude going to start crying? Like, what is the vibe? And I'm just sitting there and I'm kind of staring off the space. And all of a sudden, he just like sidles up next to me, sits down, and he's got a whole piece of pizza that he's eaten half of in like one bite. And the sauce is like smeared on the side of his face. And he just, mouthful of pizza, you're the guy I talked to about getting money? I was just like, oh, cool. I get you.
Oh my God.
It's like, what a... That was you on the stage. Like the second you got off, you're like, oh, charismatic. Like I'm together. Like so funny. And I was like, okay, I really like you. Like in that moment, I was like, I really like you.
That's
like,
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, here we are, full circle.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, he's playing on Sunday, and you know, I'm really excited to see what he does this time around.
That's
very
awesome.
Different sound now, obviously.
Yeah, pretty near the Magic slot also.
Yeah, totally.
Do you have any other thoughts on Block Party?
It's going to be great and everyone should come.
This weekend we'll both be there.
Oh, awesome.
Pelton brothers will be there. The Pelton and the Carcino brothers. We'll be there every day this weekend, and people can still buy tickets.
CapitalHillBlockParty.com. It's 21, 22, 23, if you're listening to this right away.
All right. Now let's get to the important stuff here, which is in the email discussing your appearance here, which I mentioned that burgers were going to be a topic, as they often are for us. And you said that you think that the Red Robin... has the local burger chain.
Yeah, I was going to say, local burger chain, Red Robin.
Has the best burgers in Seattle. Tell us why.
Okay, I want to preface this. I don't know if this, like, completely makes my opinion invalid, but I have a super garbage palate. Like... So maybe take this with a grain of salt. Like, I don't have a great sense of smell either, so it's like they're very connected. But I think the one thing you forget about with burgers, and this is there's a Paul F. Tompkins bit about this where he talks about cake versus pie. But the thing you forget about when you're talking about cake versus pie is cake has frosting, and that's part of the cake is the frosting. So part of the burger is the French fries.
Okay, so that's. We've sort of gone back and forth, I think, on how much to include the French fries.
Well, I'm also going to say this, too, is if you're having a burger restaurant and you're making me pay more for French fries, you just get the hell out of here with that. Like, that's
oh,
garbage.
Really?
Wait, they
so you
come
only
with the burger.
Places where they come with them?
Well, I will eat there, obviously. Like, I'm not opposed
to... But they can get the hell out of
it. Yeah, that's no, a garbage
Dick's,
policy.
Ever, never.
That's a garbage policy. I'm sorry. Well, Dick's is a little different. At least the burger at Dick's is like $2 and the fries are two more. Like, it's not like you're going down to, you know, whatever and spending $14.50 on the burger. It's like, oh, yes, sir, the aioli... You know, dip French fries are $9 more.
That is a definite subtweet of 8-ounce burger bar.
Oh, wow. Come
well, a place I really like, by the way, but I don't know.
It's no Red Robin.
Like, to me, those two things are, you know, peas and carrots. Like
burgers and fries.
You know, chocolate and peanut butter. And the fries at Red Robin, I think, are delicious. And they will bring you as many of them as you could possibly shove in your mouth. So...
There definitely are bottomless seasoned steak fries.
But I mean, it's just such a high quality. It's almost like Starbucks-esque. If you're like out of town or a little bit out of your comfort zone, it's like you can go to the Red Robin and you can have a very good burger. Nice. And it's no fuss, no muss. It's not a lot of like, they're not adding like weird, they're not putting prosciutto on there and not putting some weird goat cheese on there. It's American burgers.
American burger. I love this argument of Red Robin is the working class burger. Do you have a specific burger order at Red Robin?
I like to get the Burning Love burger, but sometimes I'll get it with a grilled chicken patty, which is a little bit different. But the Burning Love burger is good. They put the salsa and the jalapeno coins on there. It's good.
So that's the interesting thing about this. We are not going to get to Red Robin, sadly, in our search for Seattle's best
burger. Yeah, I saw that you were searching for Seattle's best burger, and you're not even going to
Well, it was on the list, but we are running out of time, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
So. We are not going to review, but I haven't had a burger at Red Robin in like a decade. I only exclusively get chicken products.
Yeah, the chicken there is really good, but I mean the burger, I think it's just so solid. Like it's very comforting, and it's a place that my wife can eat at too. We have very different sort of dietary concerns, but she can get something there that she's very happy with. So I feel like it's maybe it's Stockholm syndrome. I'm not going to like totally count that out, but. I like it.
I was curious to try one for the first time in many, many years.
You're representing the Red Robin lobby on this podcast.
I'm the one. What is that? Other people have said? I mean, this is a question, a lot of different ones.
I don't know if anybody has stood up for Red Robin.
No. I mean, I like 8-ounce. I know I subtweeted 8-ounce, but 8-ounce is totally good. I mean, Sam's over there is good. It's sort of like Red Robin inspired or whatever, but it's totally good. It's like
Red Robin inspired.
I think.
Do they have bottomless fries?
Do they? They have dollar beers. I know that much.
Good enough. There are good deals on beers at Red Robin also. So you and one of my coworkers, every time he comes to town, you guys go to Red Robin.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, why does this happen?
I don't know why it happens.
I'm so like, we're on Red Robins in Chicago?
I don't think they do.
There are numerous Red Robins in the greater Chicago
really?
Area.
I don't think they have them. I think they're lying. That's fake. We're on a group chat with, there's some guys on there, and that's sort of like a common thread is we all sort of,
Red Robin
we all
chat.
Like it in this, but it's not a shame level. Like why be ashamed? There's no such thing as a guilty pleasure.
I mean, it's not a
like if you like something, just like it, you know? So we'll go down there and they have the one by the water. We'll like, you know, just sit there and get the fries and the big weird tower of onion rings and Kevin's Googling something.
The map seems to show approximately what I'm looking at here, 7 in the greater Chicago area.
I was going to guess that there are 51 in the greater Chicago.
51?
Every location in Chicago.
Actually,
is a Red
Robin. Starbucks has a Red Robin in it. Yeah. It's a thing they only do in Illinois.
No, I love this opinion.
You asked me it, and it was the first thing that came to mind, and then I was like, you know, I should just say it. I think it's right.
That's an important thing about judging burgers, is sometimes you want to get too, you know, you want to get too fancy with it. But
I almost never like that. I appreciate it, but like, once again, as somebody who has a garbage palate, like I'm not really going to fully appreciate, you know, a certain kind of cheese or sauce or preparation or anything like that. I like real workman like food, I suppose.
I love it.
All right. Well, we've decided that because you're a Mariners fan, we are going to do our most popular segment right here.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariner's hot takes coming at ya.
Do you want to hit us with some Mariner's hot takes?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was waiting for a sound effect or something. Maybe the sound effect happened. Later. Okay.
It's in post. This is a highly edited podcast.
You're not just going to put this whole conversation up with no editing? That's wild. So a couple years ago when the Mariners were just having the most garbage time, I had to have the conversation with myself that was, the Mariners are never going to go to the World Series, and that's totally okay. And I need to be fine with that. And if I'm going to continue to watch the Mariners and care about them, I need to divorce myself from, like, this is the goal. And the goal sort of became be 500. And so, you know, they went back and forth. They had one year where it was like 82 and 84 or something weird like that. That math doesn't line up. they played six more games than any other team. It's totally fine. But they had a couple of years where they almost made it, and then they didn't. And then Jack Z was just, you know, pretty widely regarded as the worst, although he did sign Nelson Cruz, who's been just amazing. But over the last few months, seeing what Jerry DePoto has done, I think they're going to get to the World Series next year.
Whoa! That's the hottest take.
I think it could totally happen because I think they can make the playoffs this year. I think it's pretty clear that they can eke their way in. And once they're in, assuming they arrive at the right time of their weird Mariners curve where they have these insane highs and wild lows, they could just sweep all the way in. You only need to win like 16 once you're in. So they're totally capable of doing that. And just some of the moves he's made, like acquiring, just getting Gene Segura, like not to date the podcast, but the game last night where he absolutely saved the game in the ninth inning single-handedly, in addition to being the best hitter in the AL, but he got him and Mitch Haniger for Taijuan Walker, who is totally capable of being like a number three starter, but isn't there and was never there with the Mariners and was consistently one of the most frustrating players to watch because he was never good. He was great and then he'd be terrible. He was great and then he'd be terrible. It was like not a thing you could count on at all. So I just see a flurry of moves in the offseason. They're going to do something. I don't know if they'll do anything at the trade deadline because supposedly they're not getting rid of Cruz.
But you think they're making the playoffs this year?
I think they could do it. I think this week is a very make or break. This take's going to be super stupid if on Sunday they drop the next two to the Astros and then four to the Yankees or whatever. They're going to be so far out of it. But
they're calling these next like three homestands the epic homestand, right?
It was so crazy. They went to the All-Star break and they're slumping so hard. But now here we are like a week later and it's like, oh, dude, they're back. Like this is happening.
Yeah.
And when they're good, they're so good and they're so together and they're a great team to watch, which is the big difference between the Jack Z time and now. Is I feel like the team gels and it's more fun to watch than it has.
The team
been a
is undefeated since Cano hit that home run in the 10th inning of the All-Star game.
That was it.
That was the moment. The entire season turned around in that moment.
I guess you should have had some All-Star hot takes on that last week. You missed out. John Morosi, with whom I once covered the Sonics together, who was once on the Sonics beat for the Seattle PI, now at Fox Sports, says, sources, Mariners increasingly active on the buy side of the trade market now that they're 1.5 games out of the wild card. Controllable starting pitching is a priority. What do we think here?
Oh, I mean, Jerry, get in line. Controllable starting pitching, I think, is what every team in the Major League Baseball wants. But, like, who do they have? Like, I was talking to a friend about this. It's like, they like Sonny Gray. Wouldn't that be great if they could land Sonny Gray? But it's like, hey, I'll give you Ben Gamel. And
it's still high on Ben Gamel time right now.
I mean, I don't know. I liked when they acquired him. I thought he was always a good prospect, and he just had never had a chance. Like a lot of the guys on the Yankees, it's just they keep them down so long there. And then Aaron Judge comes up, and all of a sudden is just like a super beast or whatever. But, I mean, who do they give up to get anybody decent? I don't really understand, but I don't know. He's made stuff happen before. Jerry DePoto, Trader Jerry. He never wants to stop.
Yeah, it's all happening right now.
I mean, it probably is happening. He's probably sitting. He's got his polo undone to like the second button.
Uh-huh. He's got a
pacing
Red Robin
around
burger
the room. He's got a Red Robin burger. He's not eating it, though. He's just enjoying the scent because I don't feel like that guy eats. You know, I mean, who knows? But he's one of those guys that's just like, he makes a lot of weird stuff happen. Like when he traded Taijuan Walker, it was like, we really got both those guys back? Plus somebody else, too. I don't think we've even seen yet.
Really?
I mean, but those are both impact Mariners.
Yeah,
Mitch Haniger and Gene Segura. Like, even if the whole offseason was that trade, it'd be like, oh, great. But, you know, there's more to come, hopefully.
All right. I love these hot takes.
That take was maybe hotter than I had planned. but
you got in there.
I got it out. I started talking about it and I was like, you know what? It's really gonna happen. But you should check in with me in a year because I might just be in like some incurable depression. I might be having the weird like, well, if they could just be 500 like conversation again.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Eli.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was real fun.
And we'll see you this weekend at Block Party.
Yeah, exciting.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah.
And that was a hot Mariners take. A hot Red Robin take, but also a hot Mariners take.
Yeah, those takes were sizzling. I liked everything about it.
All right. So having talked a lot about Burrs, having talked about the Capitol Block Party, and then now gone to the Mariners, we'll continue our transition into sports for the remainder of this pod, starting with the latest on the Sonics Arena front. And an interesting development that isn't, again, technically related to the Sonics Arena, but continues to factor into the Oakview AEG rivalry that we've noted sort of overlies everything that's happening with the Key Arena renovation process, in acquisition by Oakview Group last week.
So they bought the touring website Polestar, and kind of is an aggregator for tours, something that we collect history for how shows have sold, grosses for shows. You'd be able to look at an artist and say, like, okay, this artist is worth this many tickets and their shows have grossed this much. Right. It's basically an industry tool, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the Key Arena renovation, but it does to me show that the Oakview Group's focus is on music still primarily.
So we talked about this earlier in the week, and my conclusion is that basically it was like NBC owning the Nielsen network that does TV ratings. Is that an apt comparison?
I don't know if Polestar is important enough to compare it to Nielsen.
Okay. Because Nielsen, of course, determines, you know, what companies are willing to pay for their ads. In this case, no one is using this data to actually make purchases. It's more just for internal use for the companies, correct?
People are using it to look at how much they should offer various artists.
Okay.
So they're looking at touring history for artists and saying, we should offer this band this amount.
The people who are booking these venues?
Yes. But at the same time, there could be some bias towards Live Nation events after this happens and towards Live Nation national tours. But I would never say that it's as important as something like Nielsen.
It's still kind of a weird case of this resource that is used by all these different companies, but is owned by one particular competitor. It's sort of like if, you know how SportView data in the NBA, it's like if Mark Cuban was the sole owner of the company that he I think he is an investor in Stats Inc. and possibly Second Spectrum, but to have him be the owner of it and then everyone else is using this data.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's something that kind of furthers, again, the competition between the Oakview Group and, you know, Live Nation and AEG, because Tim Leiwicki with a noted rivalry with AEG.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's likely to change anytime soon, given the amount of money those two companies have at their disposal to continue to spend to try to destroy the other one. So more directly on the arena front, I wanted to talk a little bit about the mayoral race and the upcoming Seattle primary elections, which will take place on August 1st. So that's coming up here 2 weeks from tonight as we record this. And Monday night, August 17th or July 17th was a debate between six of the top candidates, where after the debate, Chris Daniels of King 5 in something else they ran after the regular televised debate, asked each of the candidates to talk about their positions in the arena.
Interesting.
And then also Sonicsgate and Aaron Levine of Q13 also asked a larger group of mayoral candidates to outline in writing their positions on the arena. Not everyone participated in that. The nice thing about the debate forum is that everyone kind of had to go on the record. So there are two candidates who support the Soto option specifically. Mike McGinn, the former mayor, who of course negotiated that deal originally with Chris Hansen's group. And he seems to be making this, I think, a key point in his case for returning to the role of mayor.
Yeah. Mike McGinn's like the new Sonics guy.
Yeah, he has really aligned himself with Sonic's interests. I don't know how well this will work, but he definitely is trying to stake out that corner.
This close to dyeing his hair golden green.
Also, Jessen Farrell, who was previously in the state legislature, and while she was there, opposed the street vacation last year, but subsequently has changed her mind and now also supports the Soto option. So there are two major mayoral candidates who went on the record supporting Key Arena. Nikita Oliver, who's sort of the far-left progressive candidate, I would say, and then also Carrie Moon, who is also on the progressive side. Bob Hasegawa, it did not pick either option. He instead supports the tequila option.
I love this.
Which is interesting in as much as tequila does not seem to be an option right now.
That's a hot take.
And it's thinking outside the box. I mean, his point is, you know, basically we get all the benefits of having the Sonics back without having to deal with the problems that would create for the city of Seattle, which is all true.
He just wants to pass it off to somebody else.
Except there does not currently appear to be any money to build an arena in Tequila.
And he wouldn't be the mayor of Tequila.
He would not know. That seems like it'd be wrong for him to be the mayor of both Seattle and Tacoma at the same time. I mean, I don't think Bob Hasegawa is going to be the mayor of Seattle either, unfortunately. But
somehow we need to get somebody to support the Renton option so you can pull out your Renton Sonic shirt.
Well, he did refer to it as the Renton slash Tequila option. I mean, it's not far from Renton, so it sort of works.
Someday you're going to be able to wear that Renton Sonic shirt again.
First off, I can still wear the Renton Future Home of the Sonics t-shirt. I will always wear that with pride. Jenny Durkin, who is the favorite in this race, kind of the establishment candidate, the handpicked successor of Ed Murray, who gave her his nomination. We'll see now whether that's a good thing.
Yes.
More on that in a bit. Was noncommittal. And her response, I believe, to Aaron Levine was, whichever option gets the team back faster is what she'll support.
Interesting.
So I think the expectation from Sonics fans is that Durkin will follow Ed Murray's lead with Key Arena, but the fact that she hasn't publicly committed to that, you know, leaves the door open, certainly, to Soto eventually being her preference, or to just going with whatever the city council. I mean, the thing about this is, you know, as we've discussed in the past, at this point, it's pretty much in the city council's hands what happens with the Seattle Arena situation. Whoever becomes mayor will only have so much power, just as Ed Murray couldn't tear up the memorandum of understanding. I mean, because he could have with the city council's support, but chose not to tear up the memorandum of understanding that Chris Hansen's group signed with Mayor McGinn when he was in office. So I'm not sure how much it really matters, but it is interesting that this is an issue in the race.
Is there any chance of any fluctuation happening within the city council?
So there are two spots up for grabs. Tim Burgess, who was one of the yes voters on the street vacation and was also in office when the original memorandum of understanding with Chris Hansen's group was signed, is retiring and his position is up for grabs. And then Lorena Gonzalez, who of course was one of the no votes, but was one of the swing no votes and someone who potentially could be a yes vote in the future, she is up for re-election and I think a heavy favorite to retain that spot. And then another election that's happening is Port Commissioner. Obviously, the Port of Seattle has been a major opponent of the Soto location.
Yes.
A couple of the people running against John Creighton, who's the incumbent for this position, have staked out a pro-Soto Arena plan.
And I mean, you kind of need to have a different...
Right.
Yeah, if you're going against the incumbent, you have to have a different perspective than the incumbent.
But it is interesting that they're both now on the record as saying they don't believe that an arena in Soto will hurt the Port of Seattle, is people who are running for commissioner of the Port of Seattle.
Yes.
Politics, man. But I would say that Creighton is the overwhelming favorite to win based on
their opinion could change. His funding office also.
That is also possible. So the other story to which we alluded earlier is a report in the Seattle Times on Sunday digging up an Oregon CPS Child Protective Services report from the early 1980s that concluded that Ed Murray sexually abused his foster son at that point and they would not recommend him to become a foster parent in the future. In the wake of that, we have seen heavy calls for Ed Murray to resign. Four of the main candidates for mayor have called for that. And then Jenny Durkin, even again, the person who Ed Murray gave his nomination, his endorsement to be his successor, she was pretty, she didn't say that he should resign, but said he should consider it.
Interesting.
As did Lorena Gonzalez. She became the first city council member to really come out with that position. Several other members of the council, including Bruce Harrell, who is council president, would be first in line to succeed Ed Murray as mayor if he did step down, have indicated they don't think it's appropriate at this point. So it doesn't seem like there are the necessary votes that you'd need 6 of the 9 council members to vote in favor of removing Ed Murray from office. And that seems like an unlikely scenario. And he said on Monday that, you know, he will not step down. He will not resign. He intends to continue to serve out his term through the end of this year. We'll see if anything else comes out. Obviously, this has been a story that has continued to develop over the last several months here. if he does resign, I think that would have a more significant impact on the arena situation than whoever is elected his successor.
Interesting. Why do you think that?
Well, he's currently running the negotiations.
Yes.
So, again, he can't control it because it's up to the council to vote yes on it, and they are participating in those negotiations. But I think it would significantly change the tenor if it was someone else who is actually handling those.
This could mean that he's pushed a little bit more to the sidelines, though, in these negotiations, right?
It could. We'll see. I mean, you know,
if he weren't a lame duck mayor, the calls for him to resign, I think, would be stronger.
Yes. If he had several years left to serve on his term. I mean, the fact that we're busy electing his successor means there is less urgency in him resigning.
Do you think there's some aspect to Jenny Durkin having strong words about whether he should remain in office or not? Is her showing maybe some distance from Ed Murray?
I absolutely think that. Yes. I mean, I think that she is reading the political tea leaves and perhaps, you know, her own feelings about this new information, which I think is more damning, certainly than the previous allegations against the mayor. That's why we're seeing these calls for him to resign.
Yes.
It's from Bayesian standpoint, it changes our assessment of the likelihood that, you know, he has committed abuse.
Do we know, for the spot that Tim Burgess is retiring from, the candidates at all for that spot, do we know anything about them?
So it appeared that the two people who are considered the favorites in terms of endorsements...
These are just the primaries, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so the general election will happen in November.
Yeah, we should probably step back and clarify this. So the top two in the primary will advance to the general election in November.
Irrelevant of party.
Yeah, which... It's okay in Seattle because
it'll be a Democrat and a far leaning Democrat.
Exactly. It's a Democrat and a progressive. That's a good way to think of it. But obviously this can be an important step in the process. We saw with Greg Nichols after the twin embarrassments of the deal to let the Sonics leave, and then much more problematically for him, the city's failure to deal with the snowpocalypse of December 2008. That he did not make it through the primary is the sitting mayor.
Was it the same thing for McGinn also? I thought he got voted out in the primary also.
I cannot remember that, but I can look it up.
Seattle is notoriously hard, though, in the primary. They want to prove a point to the current mayor and then accidentally end up with two candidates. And when the voters might actually like to have the incumbent mayor.
I mean, you know, there's a lot going on in Seattle politics. We don't have enough time for that. No, McGinn did make it to the final. And by the way, that was a closer race than it gets made out to be. He lost 52-47 to Ed Murray. It's weird to me that McGinn isn't doing better in the polling now. I guess one poll did show there's a couple of polls out there. One poll did show him running second to Durkin, I think. And undecided was a heavy favorite in that one. So, again, lots to be determined here.
Who do the polls generally show is running second between Durkin is clear number one?
Yes.
So outside of this poll that you saw that had McGinn, have you seen any others that show anybody else?
Okay, so here we have the Survey USA over June 6th through 18th showed McGinn at 19%. So he was number one in that one, Durkin at 14%. And then Washington State Wire conducted June 15th through 18th had Durkin at 30%. Hasegawa at 9%, and then McGinn, a fairly distant third, at 6%.
Local polling is very difficult.
And undecided in those two polls, 38% and 28%, respectively. Also, other 11% and 17%. So there's a lot still to be shaken out of this election. I think the one thing we can say with confidence is that Durkin will almost certainly make it through to the final.
Okay. And then what about some NBA arena news?
Well,
NBA
not necessarily arena
ownership
news. Yeah, NBA ownership news. A fascinating story that really no one saw coming. Leslie Alexander, the longtime owner of the Houston Rockets since the early 1990s, announced at a press conference on Monday that the team is going up for sale. This will be the first NBA team to change hands in a couple of years here. And, you know, really with the exception of the Milwaukee Bucks, for the most part, the teams that have been sold in recent years, the Clippers, obviously, to Steve Ballmer, and then the Atlanta Hawks to a group headed by Tony Ressler. Both of those situations came under duress for the ownership. I mean, Donald Sterling actively being stripped of his ownership by the NBA and banned from the league. And in the Hawks case, we had the racist statements that were discovered in email of their former owner as part of the Danny Ferry investigation that led to that sale. So basically owners have been riding out this huge increase in team valuations that has followed both Steve Ballmer bidding $2 billion for the Clippers, much to everyone's surprise and possible, I guess, delight among owners. And then also the new TV deal, which has substantially increased the valuation for teams. So it's going to be fascinating. You know, we have obviously the Forbes estimates for what teams are worth, but those tend to understate what teams actually go for on the open market. And it will be fascinating to see where the Rockets fall. I mean, I think the expectation, the smart money is that they will go for less than the $2 billion that the Clippers went for.
Really?
Because they're not in as strong a market, and also because Ballmer probably overpaid.
Don't you think Houston is one of the fastest growing markets in the country, though?
Houston is a good market. They've got James Harden locked up for the next 6 years.
Yeah.
They've got Daryl Morey signed to an extension. They've got continuity there in the front office. So all of that, I think, makes this, you know, a team that you would expect to contend in the next several years and also to be, you know, quite profitable. They have the Chinese ties with the history of Yao Ming, and now they have Zhou Qi, their 2016 second round pick, who's coming over this year, this season. So there's a lot to like here. One name that's been bandied about as a potential owner for them is Jeff Bezos.
Oh, really?
Who went to elementary school in the Houston area because his father was working down there as an engineer.
Interesting.
So,
He's got money.
It'll be interesting to follow this. Now, for any of you who are getting excited about, could the Rockets be moving to Seattle? The answer is no. They have a lease through 2033. So above and beyond the fact that just Houston is too good of a market really to leave, that's 16
years. Would not allow the team to move to Seattle anyway.
Probably not, yeah. There was a disgruntled, I think, Rockets fan I saw in some of the comments about this who was saying, but what about the Sonics? And it's like, my friend, they had 2 years left on their lease, and they would have lost the lawsuit based on the settlement that, yes, you know, Clay Bennett eventually agreed to. They paid $15 million a year to get out of their lease. $15 million a year at 16 years. You could do the math there. It's a lot of money.
It's also a very different climate for the NBA now than it was when the Sonics moved.
Absolutely.
But you look at some of the tweets that people had. Zach Lowe, where he was saying, people have been wondering which owner group would cash out first after the dramatic rise in team valuations over the last 5 to 6 years. It seemed inevitable once the Clippers were sold that there was going to be another major market team, that there'd be another owner who would say to themselves, this is so much money, we need to sell at this point.
I mean, it's still interesting though, because, you know, when you're that rich, what's another, okay, so you think the valuation might go down a little bit because this is at a peak, it's a bit of a bubble in terms of NBA team valuation. Okay, what are you going to do with that extra $200 million or whatever? I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking about this
you're
wrong.
You're not thinking like a billionaire.
But none of them have sold their teams. I mean, what I expect to happen in the future, we've talked a little bit about this, I think, is that a number of owners will try to sell minority stakes in their team to take advantage of the valuation because of the fact that, you know, that way you still own the team, which is the fun part.
And then the other one from Bill Simmons saying that his guess is the Rockets would sell from between $2.5 billion to $2.7 billion.
I think that's a little aggressive. Although Bill Simmons has great sources in this world. So
yes, with an outside chance of it creeping toward $3
billion. If it does, I mean, I'm not sure whether that's good news or bad news for the city of Seattle, because the good news is, obviously, at some point, the expansion fees that you could charge just get so ridiculous that you kind of have to do it. But on the other hand, it's a lot more money for an ownership group to put together to put a team in Seattle.
Yes. I mean, to me, I look at it and it's like, this is the opportunity. If you are a rich guy who wants to get in the NBA, first off, you haven't had an opportunity in 5 years. Second off, there's a lot of money going around. Third off, this is the team to do it with. In some situations, it's much better than the Clippers when Steve Ballmer bought them, right? Because he wasn't buying a team that had their arena. He was buying a team that had a pretty ugly history and was the third tenant in the building.
Yep. But so, you were also, you know, in a situation where you could explore building your own arena eventually.
Sure.
So,
but I mean, there's a lot more money that's going to that. That's beyond the $2 billion that he spent for the team.
The other thing is, like, the Clippers, when Ballmer bought them, the whole point was, you know, they've been mismanaged. It's a squandered asset for a long period of time under Donald Sterling's ownership.
Yes.
You can't say that about the Rockets. There may be some more things for them to explore, but, you know, they've been well managed.
I would say, I feel like there's a better than 50% chance that they're sold for the highest amount of any NBA team ever.
Which would be more than $2 billion.
Or really any sports team ever.
Yeah, I guess that's true. All right. Moving forward. Let's talk about the Seattle Sounders.
Yeah, we haven't talked Sounders in a little while.
We've not, because they were off last week, but they will return to action with a pair of games this week, Wednesday hosting DC United and then Sunday hosting San Jose. And they will be without Clint Dempsey for those games because he has been called up to join the USMNT for the knockout stages of the CONCACAF Gold Cup.
And they're getting a little bit more serious.
Yes. The Sounders do get Christian Roldan back with the team. He was one of the players who was released from the team to help make room for some of the veterans that they brought in. And it's going to be an interesting scenario if Dempsey takes the field Wednesday night against El Salvador, because he will not be wearing his traditional number 8 for the USMNT. The call-ups have to wear the extra numbers. The original team gets numbers 1 through 23. Man. They have to get 24 through 29. So, therefore, he's wearing number 28, a combination of the two. And
Deuce Ocho.
Yep. So,
and is Jordan Morris still with the national team?
He is. So, they have a heavy chunk of the Sounders attack. And the Sounders have not as yet added an attacking designated player, as we sort of expected to see from them during this transfer period. Still time for that, of course, but that player will not be part of the team for this stretch. Kelvin Leerdam, the right back who they did add, his paperwork was not complete as of Tuesday, but still a chance that he will be cleared in time for Wednesday's match and be part of the 18. Sounders should have Chad Marshall back from the injury he suffered in their game before the break at Colorado. Brian Schmetzer said he's pretty sure that Marshall will play, but Osvaldo Alonso is still out with the injury he suffered in that game. And then also Nuhu, the young left back who has been a source of excitement in recent weeks, likely out at least Wednesday due to a dislocated shoulder. And then the MLS All-Star game rosters picked for that, Stefan Fry was the lone Sounder chosen.
Wow. I mean, you look at that in the attack that they have and not having a single all-star coming from it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Dempsey has been somewhat unlucky. I think, you know, if he'd converted his goals at the expected rate, he'd probably be there. But it's interesting for a team that's the defending MLS Cup champions.
I mean, certainly a disappointment so far. But also in this match coming up, we're going to see a team that they're going to have to explore with some of the players who may have played minutes again in these friendlies that they played, were late call-ups. They're going to have to play around the roster here a little bit.
Yeah, and the new hope being out, otherwise I think they would push Jovan Jones forward into the attack, but that might be more difficult for them to do without another option at left back. We'll probably see Roldan.
They got Ship and Bruin.
We'll probably see Roldan and Brad Evans, I would guess. Brad Evans will probably stay at right back, and then Roldan and Gustav Svensson in the defensive midfield with Alonso out, and then, yeah, rely heavily on Ship and Bruin to generate offense.
Well, that'll be interesting.
So the good news is that they're hosting DC United, who is tied for last in the MLS with 18 points, have just one win in their last seven matches, and the second worst expected goal differential, according to American Soccer Analysis. The Sounders have had DC United's number in their last six matches against DC United, have not allowed a goal and are 5-0-1 against them in that span. San Jose could be a little trickier on Sunday. Soccer Power Index on 538 has them with the worst offensive rating in MLS, but the expected goal differential puts them slightly ahead of the Sounders, basically right about even. So, you know, I think this is a week where you're targeting 4 points for the Sounders.
They need at least one victory.
You would think so, yeah. The Seattle Storm had a 90-84 win on Saturday against Atlanta and then had a chance to go into the All-Star break at 500. But alas, they squandered that opportunity with a loss at home tonight to the Chicago Sky, 94-83 in a game they led by 18 points in the first half. So this was a tough one, a tough way to go into the All-Star break. They will do so now at 8-10. They are ninth place in the WNBA single table. They don't have conferences, where the top eight teams make the playoffs. I mean, it is still very tight. They would have jumped up to sixth had they won tonight. But, you know, the schedule is going to be pretty road heavy after the All-Star break. They've had this long homestand in the month of July that they really haven't taken advantage of, losing a few times at home. So, not the kind of excitement the Storm was hoping for is they host the WNBA All-Star game this Saturday. They will have in that game, we mentioned last week, Subert as a starter, and then Brianna Stewart, of course, chosen as a reserve tonight before the Storm game on ESPN2. I would say still a chance that Jewel Lloyd makes the roster as a third player.
Really?
So Brittany Griner was one of the reserves, but she's out now for several weeks with knee and ankle injuries that she suffered recently. So they will have to pick a replacement for her. And even though obviously that wouldn't be a like-for-like replacement with Jewel Lloyd for the 6'8" Brittany Griner. Still, the fact that she's here, it's another hometown favorite. I think she does have a shot at it. They're also bringing back the 3-point shootout at halftime of the All-Star game, and Sue Bird will be among those participating.
Was it gone for a while?
It was for several years. So,
that'll be fun.
There was something.
They do everything all in one day.
There's a practice on Friday, but yes, the game and the shootout would all be on Saturday.
So when you look at the Storm first half in its entirety, do you look at it as a disappointment?
I do. I mean, I think I warned before the season that I expected, you know, if you were hoping that they were going to kind of pick up where they left off after the Olympic break last year, where they went on a big run to not only get into the playoffs, but then all the way, I think, up to the sixth seed eventually, or the I guess just the seventh seed, because they weren't at home in the first round. But, you know, they were one of the hottest teams in the league after the Olympic break last year. My thought, though, was that a lot of that was going to have to do with Sue Bird coming off of, you know, some minor knee surgery before the season. Now, as it turns out, Sue Bird has been awesome.
Huh.
She's been great. Brianna Stewart started a little slowly coming back from the sprained MCL that she suffered in China that caused her to miss virtually all of training camp. But she's been pretty dominant for the last month. What they haven't been able to do is get both Brianna Stewart and Jewel Lloyd going at the same time. Lloyd started out great in the month of May. She was really carrying the team at that point, with Stewart being and Bird coming back from injury, and then has tailed off considerably since then. And then the other aspect, it's really, you know, pretty much the same as we've seen from the Storm in recent seasons. They don't have that defensive presence because of the fact that, you know, Crystal Langhorne is a more offensive-minded center. She was historically a power forward before coming to Seattle. And then the bench has been an issue for them all season long. They're positive when Sue Bird and Brianna Stewart on the court. When those two players leave the court, they're still searching for a rotation that can kind of replace them and keep the team afloat. Saturday's game, even though they won it, was kind of the most extreme example of this in recent memory. I think they were like plus 20 with Sue Bird on the court in a game they ended up winning narrowly.
Really?
That's how badly they were by 6 points. That's how badly they were outscored with her on the bench.
Interesting.
So we'll see, you know, if they can figure that out. I don't know.
But they're still within a couple of games in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I still think, you know, we talked about this last week. They've still got a pretty good chance to make the playoffs, but, you know, they have to play better, especially on the road, than they have played thus far.
And then what about Husky Sports?
Yeah, so an interesting week here for Husky Sports. First off, men's basketball releasing the non-conference schedule, which for Mike Hopkins' first season at UW, and it's going to be a challenging one.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, we knew that they were going to play Kansas and Gonzaga. We did not know that they were going to play both of those games in the same week.
Yeah.
I mean,
it doesn't make the schedule more challenging. You would lose them no matter when they were.
That is true, but it does make it more challenging. It does still make it more challenging to bounce back from that. So they play Kansas in Kansas City on December 6th, and then they host Gonzaga that Sunday, December 10th. A number of games on Sunday as usual in the non-conference schedule, which is great because nothing else is going on
so
Sundays
dumb.
In Seattle in the late fall.
Oh my God, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, let me.
Both of these games. Wait,
no, the Kansas game is on a Tuesday.
Okay, it'll probably be like 5 o'clock on a Tuesday or something.
Yeah,
I mean, never see it.
You probably will not. No, you would have to take off work too early to do it. The Seahawks do play at 10 a.m. that Sunday that they play
the Gonzaga game.
So that won't be a big issue.
It's such a time-honored tradition to watch the Seahawks maybe win, maybe lose, and then be disappointed by Husky basketball later that night.
So the Huskies also will be in the 2K Sports Classic. They open up against Providence and then will face either Virginia Tech or St. Louis, depending on the outcome of those games. Those could be a couple more difficult matchups. And then this was the one that surprised me. So is the opening round of the 2K Sports Classic, which are played on the campus sites, and you don't actually have to win to advance to Madison Square Garden, but the Huskies have to face Belmont in their season opener on November 10th.
Oh, man.
Traditionally one of the great mid-major programs, an extremely efficient offense, exactly the kind of team that has always beaten the Huskies at home.
Maybe things are different.
Things
are different.
Like, it's not, if the Huskies lose this game, it won't even be an upset for Belmont. It'll just be the what should happen.
It's one of those games that the Huskies play where they're facing a team that doesn't seem like they're better than them because they're a mid-major team, but they're actually better. We'll come in here and beat the Huskies, and it'll look terrible. And that's how we're going to start the season.
I mean, I don't think, I mean, again, at this point, it shouldn't even look that terrible because the expectation should not be for them to beat Belmont. Like last year, the expectation.
Nationally, that's what the expectation always is.
Last year,
no matter what.
I don't know if it is, my friend. Like Belmont was 83rd in the Ken Pomeroy rankings last year. The Huskies are 163rd.
Oh my God.
Like I said, it's not an upset.
So how many tournament teams are they playing in non-conference?
Let's see. Belmont did not. I think they lost in the opening round of the Ohio Valley Conference Tournament. So despite going 15-1 in the conference regular season, they ended up in the NIT last year. The other team, yeah, I don't know if they won the Big Sky or not. I am not up on my Big Sky, I'm afraid.
Did Virginia Tech make the NCAA tournament?
I think they did. Yeah, Montana had a down year, so they did not. Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech did as a 9 seed,
okay,
yes.
Okay. So definitely a difficult schedule.
Yes.
But it will be fun to see, because Gonzaga's at UW, right? This is not at Key Arena.
Yes.
This is coming into Heck Ed.
Yes.
It's going to be fun to watch no matter what. No matter how badly they've been throttled by Kansas. Look, having them come back will be fun.
Will it, though?
It'll be fun. I'm telling you.
It might be fun in 2019. I'm open to that.
Mark your calendars.
2021, maybe? We'll see. It's gonna be a long season.
I think no matter what, if they can keep this game close, it'll be very interesting. Like, this is not the team. Gonzaga's not the team that they were last year.
That is true. So they lost Nigel Williams-Goss. They lost Schmidt Karnowski.
God, we don't have to have Nigel Williams-Goss come back here.
And then, of course, they lost Zach Collins, who was the number 10 pick in the draft by the Portland Trailblazers and shot 6 of 22 in summer league play. Let's wrap up with Husky football. Receiving a commitment from 4-star 2019 quarterback Dylan Morris from Graham Capousin.
And this was a fascinating one. You want to talk more about Graham Capousin?
Not least because we're trying to figure out whether he's actually from Graham or Capousin.
Like, it's a disorienting place. Have you ever been to Graham Capousin?
I have not.
Because I've been to Graham and I've been to Capousin.
And you were lost, correct?
You don't know what's what down there. I didn't know my Graham from my Capousin. So this is more of a fascinating one, aside from the fact that he went to Graham Capousin and the incredible amount of talent coming out of there.
Yeah, who else was from Graham Capousin?
Foster Sarrell.
Yeah, okay. So he's the first commitment for the UW in the 2019 class. And what's
of which they offered numerous players on the weekend.
Did they?
Yeah, they were offering all over the place.
Okay. So what's especially interesting is that the Huskies already kind of had a crowd in terms of future commitments at the quarterback position, because in next year's class, the 2018 class, they have both Jacob Sermon from Bothell, who is the number 2 pocket passer in ESPN's rankings, and Colson Yankoff from Idaho, who is the number 7 in those same rankings. There was a piece on this by Kyle Banagura of ESPN.com last week, noting that the last school to sign 2 ESPN top 100 quarterbacks in the same class was Florida in 2007 with John Brantley and Cam Newton. Of course, Newton ended up transferring, although I don't know that was entirely for that. He was accused of theft, right? At Florida. So it wasn't necessarily because of the crowd, but, you know, traditionally.
Does that make Jake Browning Tebow?
I guess so.
Okay.
So, you know, a 2019 commit will never share the campus with Jake Browning.
But still, he'll have 2 quarterbacks ahead of him. I mean, look, there's going to be an odd man out. Somebody is going to transfer. All 3 of these quarterbacks are not going to graduate as Huskies.
It seems pretty much inevitable, yes. Or one of them will become a tight end.
I mean, I think, what is that person's name that I can't? Jeff Lindquist.
Yes.
Right. He was a highly touted quarterback coming out of high school.
He was, yes.
So look, any of these players could be tight ends, but I consider Jacob Sermon kind of the heir apparent to the Jake Browning job.
He has the most hype, certainly, of these players. Of course, you know, you don't necessarily know until you guys get guys on campus. The other scenario pointed out by that article as a case where a team signed 2 top 10 quarterbacks in the same year was USC a couple years ago.
That's what I was going to say.
Right. And in that case, the highly touted quarterback of those 2 was not Sam. No. This was Ricky Town and Sam Darnold.
Uh-huh.
Ricky Town was the number 10 ranked pocket passer that year. And then they also signed Sam Darnold, who was kind of a late bloomer and people looked at as a linebacker. I think is that what they're recruiting him as? I believe.
I don't think I've heard that.
And then he turned out to be maybe the best quarterback prospect.
Almost surely going to be the number 1 pick in the draft.
Yeah. So, season. You know. Things recruiting rankings in the aggregate are very useful, in the individual are often wrong. So we'll see.
But I look at it could be Jacob Sermon could be the Max Brown type, and then Dylan Morris could be Sam Darnold waiting behind him.
All things are possible.
So, look, it's a good problem to have.
Right. It's a much better problem to have than a lot of the problems the Huskies had for a long period of time here.
I mean, we've always been able to sign quarterbacks, though.
That is true. Haven't necessarily been able to have good ones, but always been able to sign them.
Kind of a lot right now.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm fine with this.
So I feel like this is probably going to be the last week we don't really talk Seahawks. Training camp almost here at this point. We are a week and a half away.
And next week we wrap up Music Month, and we're going to have a music-related guest with us through the whole podcast.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
We're going to be talking.
It's going to be way better than this podcast.
they all are.
No, Eli was a great guest. We're very thankful to him for his time, and look forward to Block Party this weekend.